Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. This week's Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Florida Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.
The handout will be a little bit different than we have had in prior weeks. We are actually going to transcribe the conversation that we have so that you can have the full questions and answers that we go through. And that will be up on our website as well. So my name is Dr. Diane Sanders Cepeda. I'm sure you know, you guys know that I'm the chair of Journal Club, and we're joined today by Dr. Swati Gaur, and she told us to call her Swati, so I will, and I'll introduce her in a few moments. Shane, if you could go on, I just want to make sure that, you know, for what we're doing today, we're going to just review a state of the state and give some clinical updates, and, you know, I really want to go into and have as much time around facility readiness for our participants today. I want us to really get to our questions. So if you proceed to the next slide, this is just, you know, the latest map that we've seen from the CDC, where you can see that everywhere in the mainland, as well as Alaska and Hawaii, we are seeing cases, and as well as in many of our territories. If you proceed to the next slide, Shane, this is just an overview of what we have from the Johns Hopkins COVID-19 Resource Center, and this was last updated this morning. So at that time this morning, and I'm sure the numbers already climbed, we were at 639,664 cases in the United States. The next slide, Shane, please. This is Florida. This is as of 6:30 p.m. last night. We were at 22,519 cases, the majority of those being in South Florida, with Miami-Dade over 8,000 and Broward County around 3,500. Please remember to mute yourself if you're not speaking. On our next slide, we're just looking at the projections from the COVID-19 health data organization. You know, I know that there's been a lot of conversation in the past few weeks around whether to trust the projections. We have to remember that these are always moving, they're always evolving given the behavior that we're seeing. So with social distancing in place, we do see that there has been some movement and that there's been a bit of a leveling off of that peak. For the United States, we've reached the peak resources that we had on April 10th. And that means that to date, you know, we're seeing a higher utilization of beds and ICU beds, with all beds needed being around 57,000 and ICU beds being at 15,000. If you go to the next slide, this is more specific to Florida. And, you know, we have seen that this has plateaued a little bit from where we were, I would say, 2 to 3 weeks ago, with them predicting that we're going to reach the peak resources on May 3rd. It's, you know, it is helpful that we are implementing our social distancing, and we're, you know, we've seen extensions of those stay-at-home orders and more direction coming down from our governor, but it doesn't mean that, you know, we're not going to see peaks in our facilities. So we really do need to keep our foot on the gas pedal so that we are prepared for what we are already seeing in the facilities and what we will be seeing. So if you go with me to the next slide, yes. The first thing I want to do, since we last talked, there was some CPR guidance that AMDA put up on their website, and I just want you to be aware of this. If you haven't been on the AMDA website, They are always updating their content. They're always putting in these updates. And this was around CPR guidance during the COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to speak a little bit more about this. I'm going to definitely ask Swati some questions around this when we get to talking about advanced care planning. But I wanted everyone to just be aware that, you know, the recommendation is not only do you need to don all of your protective, personal protective equipment, there needs to be a clear plastic sheet over the patient before initiating CPR. So just let that marinate in your mind as we keep having this conversation. And then you go to the next slide, please. Yeah. So CMS on, I believe, gosh, what was that, Monday, April 13th, they came out with some a new guidance around long-term care facility transfers. And I just wanted us to make sure we're all aware of what this means. So they're really saying that if, you know, they've really relaxed a lot of the restrictions that were on our facilities for transferring between facility to facility and or discharging patients so that we can properly cohort our patients. So this is something that we're going to talk more about in this discussion today, but just wanted you all to be aware that this new guidance came out on the 13th, in addition to some new guidance from the CDC. And Shane, if you go to our next slide, you know, there's been a lot of updates around the infection prevention and control, you know, some guidance around cloth face coverings. Remember, they were saying that we could use bandanas and we could use different materials, and they sort of stepped back from that. And cloth face coverings are not considered personal protective equipment any longer because their capability to protect healthcare personnel is unknown. So there's a couple of new things out here too as well. So I just wanted you to be aware this was an update given on April 13th. If you proceed to the next slide, Shane, we're really going to jump into the conversation around facility readiness. And I want to start with a survey that we did for our members here in Florida. We asked them some questions around what were they seeing in their facility. And if you flip to the next slide, you know, the questions that we asked, it was a mini survey, you know, to say the least. And the questions that we asked really were focused around treating in place and being prepared to receive COVID-19 patients. So the highlights are, we saw that when we asked, is your facility currently admitting COVID-19 positive patients, 94% of the respondents said no. And are they treating suspected COVID-19 cases in the nursing facility? A little bit better of a response with 29% at yes and 71% at no. And the questions that, you know, I was really curious about were around the ability to test in the facility. And that was pretty close together as far as the respondents that we're able to get those testing done in the facility. But it really, to me, spoke to the fact that we are not quite ready for the surge that we are still going to see. Even though we see that some of the curves are flattening, I don't want us to relax and think that we're not going to still see that surge. We know for a fact that, you know, our governor here in Florida, he's already sending out the National Guard to do testing. I believe they, with the 93 facilities, and found 962 people who were positive. We are facing the reality that we can't move our people in and out of the hospitals the same way. We're not getting them back to the facilities or getting patients who are in the hospital discharged, dismissed, because we may only have, I think at Broward County at the last count, three places that were admitting patients. So, you know, we really need to think about how we are preparing. And that is where I want to spend the majority of our time. And we're going to talk to Swati. For any of you who do not know who Swati Gar is, she is the AMDA Infection Advisory Committee Chair, one of our leaders, and really leading our efforts with everything that we've been doing, all of the updates that have been put out really, you know, just a lot of impressive work on her part. She's a medical director and founder of the palliative care program at Northeast Georgia Health System. And she is a geriatrician. Her other specialties include palliative care, healthcare management, patient safety, quality improvement, as well as home care. So I can read all of the paragraphs, but I'm not going to do that. And we're going to just start with this discussion. Swati, do you want to have any opening comments or anything to say?
Well, it's I'm just here run-of-the-mill geriatrician. That's what I would say in my introduction. And I know there are several of us on the call today, and I'm really honored to be invited to this journal club. And one of the things that I was noticing, I was making writing some comments down, and while you were talking, Diane, and a few things that jumped out on me. One is, you know, we have looked at the peak resources, and with social distancing, we are able to kind of flatten that curve. We talk about it. We have to be really aware of the fact that, you know, in nursing homes, social distancing is, you know, the possibility of social distancing between people is really limited. They are, our residents are in, you know, enclosed areas. So, you know, despite, the flattening of the curve with social distancing outside of the facilities, I want us to be careful and be cognizant of the fact that our facilities will still be contributing to the surge despite the social distancing outside of our facilities. And that's a trend that we have seen nationally, that once a facility does get COVID patients and several COVID patients, and it's usually the control, it's hard to control, you know, at one. It's typically 20 or 30 patients, you know, that could easily contribute to the surge in your local hospital. So we are not, as much as we would love to follow what the rest of the public, the outpatients are doing, we are a very unique area where that social distancing is a constraint for us, especially in patients in facilities where patients are in two bed or three bed rooms. And so we have to be aware and be prepared for, you know, what we can do with that space constraint that we have. So that is one of the things that that stood out to me. The other thing is, I looked at the survey that you had posted, and you know, one of the things that is so incredibly important, and we see that everywhere, is testing and PPE. Testing and PPE. So the facilities that, you know, do not have access to testing, I think, you know, the biggest focus should be testing being available when you have identified that first patient, which we will, jump into, I guess, facility readiness. I'm hoping that all facilities are basically screening their patients. We in our facility started screening our patients twice a day. I think on beginning of March, we started doing that, and that we use the screening tool that is available on AMDA. And yes, we kind of came out very early, when we heard about Kirkland. I had requested, you know, three of my colleagues, and we said we are going to have to get ahead of this process and be able to put out some guidances and some tools that we can all use. And that's when the process of writing the guidance started. So just a little background about the guidance.
So that gets me to the first question around the section prevention and control. So with testing, we know that we still have facilities. And in our survey, about 34 people responded, I believe. So it wasn't even the majority of our membership. I know that we have facilities that we're not testing our residents or our staff and everything else. And my question really is, how should we, you know, being the leaders, being the clinicians and the medical directors attending to these facilities, what should we be doing to encourage our facilities to be more transparent with their capabilities and with testing? You know, we know that we have cases of people who are in the hospital now and the facility has informed the staff. You know, so what should we be doing? How do we lead in those circumstances?
So, you know, as medical directors, I think, you know, it's really the situation has brought the medical director role to the forefront, right? So because we are the ones now that, you know, who have to provide guidance as to how to deal with this, because, you know, it's not coming bound with regulations. For the most part, and the situation changes very quickly, and it's really a pandemic, and you know, you have to make decisions really based on your medical judgment. So, you know, I think this is the perfect time for medical directors to shine as leaders and make our administrators and our DONs and, you know, all departments really to understand how critical it is to have that testing capability, how critical it is to, you know, have proper infection control processes in place, how critical it is to have PPE to protect your staff. And here's what I would say. This is something that I have heard over and over and over from medical directors all across the country. If there is disease in your community, let's not ever, you know, be in any illusion that it is not going to come to your facility. So, you know, we have to be very cognizant that it will enter the facility via staff, via admissions, via dialysis patients who are going out, via patients who are going out for other reasons to other offices. And I will quickly tell you our facility's experience. We stopped visitation prior to the CMS coming out, you know, with their visitation policy. I had to really talk to my administrator and talk about, you know, the importance of restricting visitation, even though we know it's so, so hard. And, you know, I was extremely lucky to be successful in that endeavor. We started screening our patients twice a day, every shift, with that screening tool, which is basically temperature of more than 99, any respiratory, low respiratory, you know, issues, myalgias, nausea, diarrhea, et cetera. And, you know, so we started doing that early March, and we started testing our patients. I think our first test was sent out on 11th of March. Our first test came back positive on 31st of March. And that was solely based on implementing that screening tool and processes in place, because that patient, it was an interesting case, and this is a cautionary tale for all of us. We had a screening tool in place. We had processes in place. That gentleman was essentially had indwelling Foley catheter, was a do not transfer to the hospital, a hospice patient, and basically had a fever of 100.3 and headache. That's all the symptoms that he had, and lower abdominal fullness. And, you know, so the clinician in me said this could be a CAUTI. But because we had the screening process in place and he had two of the criteria that he met, you know, fever and headache, I said, let's send, go ahead and send a COVID. Clinically, I worked him up. He had a white count of 20,000. And we treated him with IM, ceftriaxone, sent out a culture came back positive. He responded to it, but his COVID test came back positive. So basically, that's the power of having a screening tool and a process in place. We would have completely missed this patient had we just gone by our clinical suspicion, because he had a CAUTI in addition to, you know, having COVID. After that, we extensively tested our facility and we found 8 patients. 6 out of those 8 in the same hallway, completely asymptomatic, never got onto our list of respiratory isolation or respiratory log that we were keeping. And one of the things to go back to facility readiness, I hope everyone is keeping a respiratory log of your patients. CDC has a great respiratory log tool I'd be happy to share. We use the respiratory log, we use the building map, and we start making every morning. I have 15-minute clinical meetings with my facility, and we make those little check boxes to find those clusters of respiratory issues that may be going on. And that's where we found the cluster on one of our units. And then we tested our staff. I'm not saying that you need extensive testing, but you know, this is an experimentation that kind of happened. Somebody offered us the test. I didn't want to say no, of course. And we tested our staff. 15 out of 119 staff members were positive, asymptomatic positive. So a lot of lessons that came out of that experience. And the lesson is not to, you know, not to say that we can't do it anything if we don't have testing. My other building did not get the opportunity of getting that extensive testing done, but we learned a few lessons that we implemented everywhere, and I'd be happy to share.
The success of your practice depends on a support team that knows exactly how to navigate through the many variables and nuances of post-acute medicine. Based on years of practical clinical experience, the team at U.S. Post Acute Care is dedicated to enabling you to deliver the very best quality of patient care, providing a unique complement of administrative and clinical educational support services. To learn more about what U.S. Post Acute Care can do for your practice, visit uspostacutecare.com.
So when you were, you know, identify these patients, what were the strategies that you took and that your facility took to cohort them, isolate them, either in their rooms or to a wing in the facility?
Yeah, so once we identify, so, you know, until you have that first patient of COVID, you know, the exercise is really to keep those respiratory logs, put people on respiratory isolation, test them if you can, and then, you know, start taking them off of isolation as you can. But once you have that COVID-19 patient, what we did is, you know, and this is, again, going back to the preparedness, you really have to identify now, like what we did that was, I think, smart was, we identified a different wing that was, you know, separated from our rest of the facility with administrative offices. And we basically said that we are going to take that wing and we're going to make it the COVID unit. And nobody would come from that wing into the rest of the facility. So now we have a wing that is really acting like their own little facility. And the entrance doesn't have the same, it doesn't have the same entrance. The staff is completely cohorted. The supplies are completely cohorted. And so that is a very big preparedness plan that you have to make, because once you have a patient of COVID-19 in your facility, that spread. So you got two goals. One is containment. And for that, you got to be able to take that patient out and cohort them somewhere else, because it's, you know, almost impossible for the staff to take care of a non-COVID patient and then take care of a COVID patient in the next room. It's just, you know, it requires that we don't really know, you know, how have full understanding of the spread of this disease. So it's really a dangerous proposition, in my opinion. So doing that, and then the other preparedness is really now you have these acute patients that you're kind of building a little acute care setup inside of your nursing home. So those two become your goals when you have, once you have a COVID-19 patient in your facility.
So once if there's a clinician who, a physician or nurse practitioner or physician assistant who's on that unit, they enter through that unit, don their protective personal equipment and see the patients there, and then before they can go to the other side of the facility, they have to leave that unit separately?
I would say that if the same person is going to the two different areas, what you want to do is really be able to round on the areas that don't have COVID. And then at the very end, go to the areas that have COVID to just minimize that fomite-based spread. Yeah.
Okay. Are there any criteria or ventilation standards for declaring a room to be airborne isolation within the facilities that we need to be aware of?
So one of the things that, you know, is it has become very important in Georgia that I will tell you, we are notorious for our allergy season, which is upon us right now. So what we are doing is we are extensively treating our allergies in our patients and staff. We are basically telling the staff to get ahead of it and be, and start, you know, so that they are not coming to the facility and sneezing, or this, you know, our patients are not sneezing, because that's one airborne spread issue that we get into. The other thing that we did, and we did that early on, is we eliminated complete, except for one person who has open suctioning and an open tracheostomy, and they need, you know, they have frequent mucus plugging and they need mucomist to thin out her secretions. Other than that, every single patient is now on a albuterol inhaler or inhaler where they were on nebulizer before. What we have done is we have floor stocked albuterol tablets and albuterol syrup. When we initially give this to our patients, we are very cognizant of the side effects of, you know, causing anxiety and tachycardia. So we are monitoring them very carefully. But I have been surprised with the number of people who can tolerate it and take it and find relief. And we have done the same thing with our COVID unit patients, is, you know, use the same albuterol syrup or albuterol tablets if we can. So that is one of the things that you got to do. The other thing that we have done, you know, jumping to PPE, is we have given masks, N95 masks to our staff. We have reached out to our Department of Public Health, and we create a list of you know, PPE supplies, and you can access how many PPEs you're gonna need. It's on the CDC website, that formula, and we basically do that readiness at least once or twice a week, readiness meetings, and make sure that we are keeping ahead of that PPE game. And then, of course, prioritizing PPEs, you know, differently for different isolation patients. For example, if you have limited gowns, then you need to really be able to prioritize your gowns for people who are PUIs, or you have on respiratory isolation in the regular units, because they could end up being testing positive for COVID. Those are the people where you have to really be able to discard your gowns. People who you are keeping for observation who are not having any symptoms, for example, new admissions or dialysis patients, you could potentially look at using fabric gowns or other, you know, other interventions that people have.
Okay. So the question that keeps coming up from many of our members is, how long should we isolate the suspected COVID-19 patient or the asymptomatic patient, and for those people who test positive, following their symptoms resolving, how long do they need to remain in isolation?
So, so isolation is different for different people, right? So one of the things is, today we talked about in our morning meeting about COVID patients. COVID patients who are 14 days away from their last symptoms, we are going to be testing them at 14 days away from the last symptoms. If their first test is negative, we will be testing them a second time. So using CDC's testing-based strategy before we can bring them back into and assimilate them back into our units. Because we have had COVID in our building, and testing, depending on who you talk to, you know, people talk about up to 25 to 30% false negatives, and that's a very high number for my comfort. So really what we have been trying to do is You know, once we have had it, if a patient has had a symptom, they're having to be tested, they're having to be isolated for 14 days because we have had that in our facility. New admissions, we are trying to bring them in a new wing, you know, in a separate wing, or rather we have created a little area that we are just trying to keep our new admissions. And, you know, when we are space crunched, what we do is we would cohort our new admissions together, like a 13th day with a 13th day, an 8th day with an 8th day, et cetera, rather than cohorting a first day with a 13th day, because that could be causing a little bit of a problem. You know, we are also very space crunched with, you know, now we don't have those empty rooms. So when we have to, you know, isolate a PUI, sometimes it has become really hard for us to actually even take the patient out from that room. So what we have done is we have changed our processes of how we were doing things and made sure that all the curtains are drawn at all times. If we cannot isolate that patient in a separate room, we started using cloth masks for patients. And cloth masks are really for the fact that the patients are not sharing their droplets. It's, you know, it's primarily for them not to expose other people to the droplets, for which cloth masks could still be a reasonably effective, issue. So.
So going back to the cohorting of new admissions, you're cohorting them whether or even if you don't know their COVID status. So the unknown or the negative COVID patients are being cohorted to all new admissions?
Yes, all new admissions. In fact, when our returns are coming back from the hospital, we are also cohorting them, you know, as new, we are treating them as new admissions. And your ideal course of action is, what we did to begin with is when we had our admission coordinator and an independent nurse were looking at our admission paperwork that we were getting from the hospital, they would review the paperwork and the patient's course in the hospital and match it, you essentially run our screening tool against that record. And if they failed the screening, we would ask the hospital to do a test. Now I know that there are a lot of places that are saying, well, we just need a negative test. And that is all fine and good. But we also need to understand the fact that, you know, the patient may have had exposure 2 days prior, 3 days prior to discharge. So you still have to go ahead and cohort. And the ideal, you know, CMS says that you should be able to cohort for 14 days. And that's what we are trying to do. But when we are space crunched, what we do is we basically put the two patients together, separate them by curtains, and try to keep the days, you know, the days out of hospital, kind of cohort them by the days out of the hospital. Okay. Does that answer the question? I know there.
I think it did. The question that another question that I wanted to get out there was around considerations around our maintenance services, laundry, food distribution during these times of trying to cohort patients. What do we need to do in regards to that? What things do we need to consider to make sure our building is ready? And all the different service lines are ready to,
yeah,
to do this.
Yeah, that's a great question because I had written down that and you know we are trying we are finding things out by trial and error. So EVS, talk to your EVS ahead of time because I can tell you when we decided that we were going to cohort our COVID patients in a separate unit, we have thought about everything. We have thought about contingency of everything, and literally 3 days prior to we had the fact that we had to actually do it, I said, you know, I feel like when we find out the results and we start to do this, we are going to have to do it at 2 a.m. And our EVS services come at 6 a.m. in the morning and they leave at 3. So what we did is we created a schedule and staggered those services and EVS created an on-call schedule. And one of the things that I would say is, do a town hall in your facility. Do a town hall, talk to everyone. Everyone needs to be involved in this. your kitchen staff, your EVS people, your nursing staff, everyone needs to be involved in this. And then, you know, again, resources for readiness, right? Your pharmacists need to be involved. And, you know, the way our pharmacist helped us out, the consultant pharmacist, is I said, let's go over all labs that we have scheduled for the next, you know, 3 months and see what are the essential labs. You know, if somebody is not having, I don't know, sudden increase in their hemoglobin A1C, there is absolutely zero need for us to get a hemoglobin A1C during this time. That can be had about 3 months later or two mm-hmm. months later. Your TSHs that are normal, you know, they don't need to happen. So look and start cleaning up those labs. The other things are QAM, ACHS, blood sugars. Not everyone needs blood sugars 4 times a day. So our consultant pharmacist was, you know, reviewing the blood sugar saying, oh, Dr. Garr, it's like between 150 and 250. I'm like, good. We just need to check them, you know, less frequently. So doing that. Eliminating all the nebulizer treatments. We did that together. Changing the QID medication schedules to, you know, at least to get it to TID, you know, to limit the exposure to the patient as well as the staff. So that those were, you know, important considerations. Discontinuing the MBIs that, you know, maybe making patients sick, you know, first thing in the morning, you pop a MBI, you know, multivitamin, and everyone is trying to throw up. So that was the other important thing that we did. When we talk about having, you know, treating in place, one of the important things that, you know, somebody, another medical director had told me is, your oxygen tanks that are our regular oxygen tanks in our building are not going to be enough. You got to have some high flow oxygen tanks, high, you know, 10 liter concentrators, 15 liter concentrators. So that is an important consideration. Make sure you got plenty of spacers. You know, you will need them. Once you have a COVID patient, make sure that you have some kind of an order set, because they will need, if they get short of breath, they do get short of breath, and we will need that morphine to in Ativan to help them with that air hunger. And what we did is we created an order set, and we said, you know, we're going to put it for every COVID patient, whether we are going to need it or not, we're going to put it as a PRN use so that we have it in our building and we are not just run out of morphine, you know, when the patients need it.
Yeah. Swati, I had two questions that came from Dr. Diaz through the chat. The first is there any data that COVID-19 negative patients that are hospitalized and test negative in the hospital were at greater risk of getting COVID-19 at the hospital? That's the first question.
Yeah. I think what he is saying is, if we send a COVID negative patient, are they at a high risk for acquiring from, he may be talking about like nursing home patients. Yes, there is data that says that nursing home patients are at high risk of acquiring COVID. And I think it is not just because they are in a limited space in the nursing home, but they are also, you know, older and typically have multiple medical problems. So high risk of acquiring, high risk of poor outcome, and high risk of death. So all three of them. Is there data that shows that they are at high risk of acquiring in the hospital? I have not seen that data. But the bottom line is, if it's in your community, you know, the chance of exposure is there. And that's why you want to make sure that you're treating every patient who's coming back to you as if they are, you know, they could develop COVID during those 14 days.
And then the second question was, are you recommending testing residents and staff even when there is no known COVID positive patients in the facility?
So what we have done and what I would recommend is have your screening tool and your screening, you know, process. And if they, if that screening tool, you know, gets you any patients that you have suspicion, then you know, basically case-by-case basis do your COVID testing. So I'm not recommending this, you know, overwhelming test. I mean, if anybody has any access to those kind of tests, please let me know.
So I want to jump to PPE. I know you've mentioned this a couple of in a couple of your answers prior, but I want to really talk about conserving PPE and,
yes,
and what your facility has done. We do have a question about can you wear the same PPE to care for different COVID-19 patients? So if we could have that full-on discussion about how to conserve, and when we can wear the same gowns and masks and when we can't, that would be great.
Yeah, sure. And first of all, let me just say that officially you really have to go to the CDC website and look at their regular use of PPE, their contingency use and their critical use, and try to stick with that. And I can tell you that honestly, the way people are having to deal with PPEs, it really depends on facility to facility. And I know of a lot of nursing home medical directors saying, this is what we have used. People have used anything from that yellow PPE that seemed to us as, so like almost worthless, right? We wear it, we tear it off, and it goes in the garbage. Mm-hmm. And now we're like, now we are wearing garbage bags for PPE. So I have seen all ends of the spectrum. It really depends upon what you have. So yes, to answer that question of once you have a COVID unit, can you conserve your PPE? Technically, yes, you could. However, you have to realize that the patients may have different infection tag other than just COVID. So that's what we did also when we were cohorting the patients, the MRSA people, you still have to worry about, does this person have ESBL? Does this person have MRSA? Does this person have, so let's not, spread other infections while we are trying to, conserve our PPE or really focusing on COVID. So that consideration goes into it, but, have we used gowns from one COVID patient to the other COVID patient, reuse the gowns? Answer is yes. Is it the best thing to do? No, but it is a critical supply. I can tell you what we are doing is we only have X number of those yellow PPE gowns. And what our staff is having to do is for the low risk stratified patients who are not having any respiratory symptoms, they are literally using hospital gowns right now. And they wear the hospital gowns over it. We have told the staff to only wear short sleeves so that the hospital gowns can cover their clothing and then do their whole hand washing right up to the elbow. We have reached out to community volunteers and, people who sew with recipes of, fabric gowns that can be laundered, and they are in the works, but we don't have it yet. But I think we are going to look into that. As far as the conserving the PPEs are concerned, now that we have a COVID positive building, most of our staff is wearing N95. What I have requested is that every staff be given N95, at least 3 masks, and they have their name written on that mask and they have the days written on their mask. And basically what they do is they take the mask, they wear it on one day, they take the second mask, they wear it on the second day, third mask, the third day. And you may have seen how people are conserving their N95s. Basically, you take a shoebox, typically a cardboard shoebox, you stick your head in it, you take the, strap off, you take the other strap off, and now the shoebox is wearing the mask, and you take your face away from it. The shoebox is wearing the mask inside out, and that's how you just leave it out to dry. And that's the way that we have been conserving our PPEs. But please reach out to your Department of Public Health and ask for PPEs.
Yeah, I think Dr. Healy demoed that on her COVID-19 talk.
That's right.
I think we had a video of it.
I'll be happy to send the video.
That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful. It was a really good video. I don't know if she patented the whole technique, but it was wonderful. We have some questions more related to medications and the workup of a patient. The first is from Dr. Farini, and is, do COVID-19 patients seem to need higher doses of morphine and Ativan for palliative care?
Yes, is the answer. I think they are needing, people who are having a lot of shorts of breath are needing higher doses for morphine and And at events. So we don't want to run out as a facility. You don't want to run out of that. So I think one of the ways that we have found is, you know, just request as a PRN dose for all patients, and then, you know, so that there is some supply available inside the facility. That's one workaround that we have had for those patients. The other I would say is these patients have significant myalgias and aches and pains, and sometimes not controlled with plain Tylenol, and you will have to give that morphine for pain control also. So that is the other issue. Don't just treat a fever with Tylenol, treat the pain, the myalgias that patients are having.
And Dr. Pandia also had a question. She had questions, are you seeing patients presenting with neurovascular symptoms or hematological problems like clotting or bleeding? She has a patient who has developed sudden thrombocytopenia. So she's asking that question. And I hope I did you justice, Dr. Pandia.
Yeah, no, I have not seen, fortunately, my, really the number of COVID patients that I have seen are very limited. And honestly, the eight, I try not to talk about my patients. I've become superstitious. This is terrible. But you know, some of them have not had very many symptoms, and, you know, we're going to keep our fingers crossed. And, but no hematological symptoms, although I know that they may end up in DIC, et cetera, you know, when they get really, really sick. That's something that we have seen in the literature.
I think, you know, for the sake of time, we need to start shifting to advanced care planning.
Yeah.
I want to make sure, you know, we get your thoughts about what we need to do, how we need to evolve the conversation. You know, hopefully we're always and have always been having these conversations and very realistic discussions, but how has that changed now given COVID-19?
So yeah, thank you for talking about that. Dr. Pandya and I have been in conversation about that actually, and, you know, coming up with a tool that hopefully we would be able to make it available to everyone. It's critical that we talk about this disease with our patients and families, especially once there is a diagnosis, because whatever the previous thought was, it really needs to be revamped. And this is why. It is a deadly disease. You know, the numbers, the case fatality rates in nursing home population were 33.7, I think, or 33.4. NEJM article, you know, out of Kirtland. We have seen the most recent study that came out on in-hospital coding of patients, and going back to that coding thing slide that you had shown, showed that out of 136 patients that were coded in Wuhan who had, pneumonias associated with COVID-19, they were in hospital. They 98% almost were witnessed arrests. The code was done within 1 minute, and 4 out of those 136 people survived. And one out of those 136 people had a favorable neurological outcome. That's really bad. You know, these are really poor numbers of witnessed cardiac arrest. Here is the problem. You know, the code is, first of all, you know, I know we talk about futility and not to use the word, or we don't talk about futility. However, if you talk to some of the medical directors like Jim Wright, you know, in Virginia, he talks about how, you know, it's a procedure that really doesn't benefit the patient. So then what is the most important thing? If you do actually have to code a patient, you got to think about your healthcare provider, the person who's coding them, and you have to worry about their life and their health. And which means coming back to readiness, your crash carts should have at least 2 sets of PPE, that clear plastic sheet. And I don't care if they have to take a clear garbage bag and have it. And basically the sheet covers the patient, their face, and their upper chest. And if you're using that ambu bag, and if you plan to use that ambu bag, the ambu bag needs a filter. So all those 3 modifications need to happen in the code card. The code card stays out the only two staff members go in. This is a protocol that we have gone over and over. One of the people really, all they do is take that bag and that mask and they put it, seal the patient's face. And the reason for that is when you do chest compression, there's a chance that you're going to have the droplets come out of patient's mouth, and you got to protect your staff. You don't break that seal all through that code process if you actually had to code somebody. So what I'm saying is that coding somebody, by the time patient need to coding, they're not going to survive. So it's very important for us to then go back to that advanced care planning piece. And the problem here is that you're now talking to the families who have not seen their patients, their loved ones, for a little while. And now we are giving them a diagnosis of COVID, which is scary, and telling them about do not transfer, do not hospitalize conversations. So we have to be really cognizant that we are giving them, and the other thing that happens is when the patient's families are not coming into the building, they also have this communication gap because everyone is focused on COVID in the building. And that communication has been, broken off, where typically they will come, they will say, oh, what's going on? They feel like they know what is going on. So families are anxious. They don't know what is going on. You've got to have a structured conversation. You got to tell them what it means to have COVID. You got to tell them the outcomes. You got to acknowledge it is so hard for the families not to be able to see their loved ones. And then you got to broach that and talk about what you have prepared in your facility to take care of that patient. We are going to take care of your loved one.
We are closely approaching time, and I know we have more advanced care planning questions, but I want to make sure we just touch upon hydroxychloroquine and all of this, and whether or not you're using that with azithromycin in your facilities. And I saw some of the guidance that came out from AMDA. So if you could talk about that maybe in our last few minutes.
Sure. I'll try to be quick. Yeah. One of the, since we talk about, so there are no good studies that support hydroxychloroquine. That's the number one thing. Number two is, I would probably not blame somebody who is dealing with a patient who is really struggling with COVID and having a lot of symptoms to say to themselves, what can I do to help this person? And I think that's what we have to recognize is if you are at a point where you're ready to throw snake oil at them, nobody is gonna fault you. But you gotta make sure that you're not, so people who are, 10% of the people are going to go downhill. Our first death of the COVID patient was literally, we are doing 2-hour oximetry checks. He was 97%. He was normal. And then 2 hours later, he was gone. So those people do not benefit. People who, I have 14 patients who are going to be tested again because they are free of symptoms. They won't benefit. I would probably give them a side effect. If there is a patient who's really struggling and you want to use it, use it. The problem with using hydroxychloroquine and Zithromax is QT prolongation. There are plenty of studies that are out that say that there's significant QT prolongation. Let's not give something to patient that they didn't have. Talking about anecdotes, Jim Wright said, anecdote after anecdote is still an anecdote. It doesn't make a good study. Talking about anecdotes, one of my latest COVID positive patients has been on hydroxychloroquine for rheumatoid arthritis. So if somebody thinks that, of course my N is equal to 1, but you got to take it with a grain of salt. Make sure that you're doing risk benefit analysis when you're trying to subject patients to toxic medications.
In the last few minutes, can you talk about how do we care for our staff, our nursing home staff, during this, what things do we need to think about for that nursing home worker?
Yeah, so I think that is a very important question. First of all, the best thing that you can do with for your staff is ensure that they have PPE, adequate PPE, adequate PPE. And one of the things that we did is, you know, when we had this come through and we were told that, well, you don't have enough PPE for your staff, you know, just wear a regular mask, you know, I have to go and fight with them, you know. So be the cheerleader for your staff. One of the things that every single staff member is now doing is wearing a mask and then putting a face shield on. So we are providing two levels of protection to the staff, and we're hoping that that would work because it's really, really, really important for us to protect our staff. You must have heard of some facilities that have actually lost their staff. I cannot imagine doing that or losing that. So it's very, very important for us to protect our staff. Secondly, morale. You know, we as nursing home industries are inundated by being on the front page of a newspaper. And then the second thing is state surveyors coming and basically telling us what we are not doing right. And I think as medical directors, you know, this time more than any other time, it's so important for them to know that you stand by them. Do town halls, do Zoom meetings, be in front of your staff. It's critically important. What we did is I reached out to my, you know, we are a health system. We reached out to the auxiliary, or I reached out to actually the community. And I said, you know, what you need to do is, we see this healthcare heroes everywhere, and the biggest heroes that work are really in long-term care. And so our community volunteers came and put, you are our heroes, all across, all around our facilities. And the staff was, you know, they are working low pay, you know, long hours, and they are spending their whole time, and they're very aware of the fact that these patients that they love, they are going to lose 1/3 of them if they had COVID. So you got to understand, when my staff coded that person, you know, we had to go into a therapy session. She cried, I cried. And this is because it's extremely traumatic for the staff to take care of these patients and see them go. So please make sure that you do, you know, you do show your kindness to the staff. I know you feel for them, but I think at this point of time, they need to see you express it.
Yes. Swati, we want to thank you for just joining us today and answering all of our questions. I know we didn't get to all of the questions. Some of you sent me questions privately. I have copied all of those questions and I will get answers for you. I just thank you. And anytime you want to come back and talk to us, you're more than welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And it's an absolute honor. I know y'all have some great membership that I look up to, really. You know, so thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. And this session has been recorded. There will be a transcript of the discussion that will be provided as a handout instead of standard slides. Thank you all for attending.
Support for this podcast is brought to you by U.S. Post-Acute Care.